Welcome to Encounters in the EAP Classroom, a podcast that reflects upon different experiences in the higher education English language classroom and provides thoughtful suggestions for both learners and instructors. I'm your host, Laura McNabb. Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining me today. So this semester, I'm working with year one students in their second semester, and I'm noticing something with them that I've noticed many times before, especially with first year students and often in second year as well, is that tendency towards having opinions without referencing and without referencing any outside sources. Now, first of all, I just want to state that I do recognize that this practice of referencing is definitely more familiar to people who, according to Hall in his work in 1976 on high context and low context cultures, so he says, you know, a low context culture is a culture where things are stated explicitly and there's no room for misinterpretation, and there's lots of evidence and facts presented. Now, this is compared to a high context culture, which would have information stated in a more kind of sophisticated, possibly metaphorical style, with the purpose of leaving it open for wider interpretation. So in this low context idea, that means that there are going to be facts and there's going to be evidence added to the very explicit statement. Now, most English medium instruction institutions that include an EAP program are often designed, if not closely, fairly loosely, on a more Western-style institution from a low-context cultural background. Yes, I sound very hedging and qualifying because, truthfully, I cannot speak authoritatively on the background of every single tertiary institution. I only know what I've experienced myself and what others that I've talked with have experienced, but it seems to be a fairly accurate generalization for English medium instruction, transnational, international institutions. And so a low context, linear, and explicit environment, which uses facts and evidence, is definitely not the only way to communicate, as we know from a high context society, and it's not the best way. But it seems to be, and it is definitely the chosen and preferred style of the institutions at which I've worked and the one that I'm presently working. So I think it's helpful to think about how to invite and welcome undergrad students into this cultural environment of study and research and bringing in this referencing. And this is what I really liked about the CEFR descriptors, the Common European Framework for Reference of Languages, and the adapted macro functional basis that they have. So in the new macro functional basis, there are three types of language communication, and there are four categories. Now, the four categories are reception, production, interaction, and mediation. So this is different from the traditional four categories, which was simply reading, writing, listening, and speaking. Now, the framework macrofunctional basis, as I mentioned, has three types of language communication, and that is like the creative, kind of interpersonal, so, you know, your day-to-day conversations, creative writing, poetry, etc. Transaction, which is much more fact and information based. You think of transactions like when you go to a bank or you go to a supermarket, or simply when you have, you know, a test that asks you what's the capital city of Algeria. Now, And the third type is evaluative problem solving, which tends to show up more in a discussion type of way. And the so we've got production skills and reception skills, and then they've added interaction skills and mediation skills. So already we've now expanded that basis, right? It's not just reading, writing, listening, and speaking, but it's reading and listening, writing and speaking, and then interaction, and then mediation. And mediation, you know, is a go-between. When you mediate, you are, you know, often we think of it as dealing with a conflict between two other people. But basically, in the CEFR's thinking, it's the idea that you are mediating then the ideas of different people, maybe who are present in your conversation, but also research and texts and other things, other sources that you have learned about before you've come to the present discussion. Now, in the Pearson blog, Goodyear in 2020 wrote, and he summarized basically mediation activities, suggesting that this includes things like helping people understand each other. So that would be mediation at a, you know, conversation, personal level, helping people understand between different ideas and sources. So then we could be, you know, transactionally mediating, paraphrasing information so that it's more understandable, and then also co-constructing meaning, either between people present, but mostly also adding in references and sources. So you can see where this mediation then allows a student, allows any speaker, to make a connection between the person they're currently speaking face to face with, or, you know, screen to screen with, and someone else's work who they may have just been reading about. So when my friend, you know, mentions blah blah blah, and then I'm like, oh yeah, that's the same as so and so wrote in her book, da 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 da. And I am mediating between the person I'm talking with and something else that I wrote. And we do this all the time, right? This is so common. Oh, that's like a movie I saw. Oh, that's just like that song. Oh, I had this experience. Oh, I read this. Oh, I saw that. We're constantly bringing in other information. We're constantly mediating. And, you know, so it's not only just that you are interacting and co-constructing, but even you're adding and co-constructing with these outside sources. Now, social learning and co-construction and this constructivist idea, this is like the Russian psychologist Vygotsky, who suggested, you know, that social learning, so already that interaction, allows for co-construction and mediation. Now, the French psychologist Piaget, suggested more that, you know, I need to develop my cognitive abilities and then I can navigate a social setting. But regardless, there's still that sense that we're not, you know, learning a language, we're not learning information to remain, you know, closed and individual and separate, but rather that it's to become part of a social group or a social scenario. And, you know, that is basically what undergrad students are doing. They are joining the social setting of the academic community, the university, or, you know, the technical college, the polytechnic. They're joining this community, and they need to be invited. They apply to join, but then, you know, welcomed. And when you think then that once they're in the community, that they need to acknowledge, oh, yes, so-and-so read their work, and they mentioned, like, they're going to start adding names as well. Which is interestingly quite different from what I witness a lot of the time, which is instead a performative language. So if we come back to like the EAP classroom and what we're doing there, and often it seems it can feel very performative. So it's like, do your research and write a paper. Now, who are you writing to? Well, in a sense, no one. Your teacher is going to grade it and tell you, you know, did you do a good job or not? Or give a presentation. Who are you really presenting to? Well, your teacher, and your teacher is going to give you a grade on it. And, you know, there are also definitely performative situations that we go, you know, you go to a conference and you give a speech or give a presentation, and it's not necessarily that you're going to be talking to anybody in the process of the presentation, but rather once you get done and, you know, you go for a coffee at the back of the room, it's quite likely that somebody will come up to you and say, oh, so you mentioned, and begin the interaction that's now face to face in the minute. And, you know, you're probably going to start adding more knowledge and more sources into that conversation. So that, to me, is that space that undergrad students, especially in year one, they're just, I don't think they're really aware of it. They're not aware that, you know what, you are now in this community. And I still remember, my modern poetry class. It was third semester, so that was the fall semester of year two. And we were studying T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. And, you know, this was already, this is a lot of work trying to figure it out, trying to understand it, you know, all of the language and definitely very creative language. And then the professor says, you know, so what do you think? You know, what does this mean? And it was like, what? He's asking us? You know, he wants to know what we think. Of course, it could have been that he was just testing to see who read the poem and, you know, who's doing their homework. But that didn't matter to me. Like, I was sitting there going, wow, I have been asked what I think about this. And I am in the English literature community. You know, I'm in the club. And that was such a powerful moment for me. And so, you know, I ask myself this question, am I inviting my students into the academic community? And I ask you this question as well. Are you inviting your students into the academic community? Or am I adding to a narrative that many of them already have, which says, I'll get into the community once my English is better, or once I understand all the rules, then I'll actually join the community. But right now I'm still preparing. Which, okay, to be fair, like, you know, we call them foundation programs, often we call them bridge programs. So there is a sense of that. But truth be told, they're in the community. They're at this campus. They're coming to this space. They're there. And inviting them in and bringing them in, and then we continue to work with them. Because they're already, you know, as I said, they have this idea that I'm not quite ready. And for so many, especially, you know, when they're choosing to do a transnational education program in their home country. So like my students right now are studying in English, they're studying a UK curriculum, and they're still in China. But that basically means that they are now using English all the time in all their classes, interactively, and, you know, doing everything in English, and yet still living in a country for which basically they need no English for day-to-day life, and they haven't done this before. And, you know, not only now do they have to have good grammar and the proper vocabulary just so that it's correct, but they also need it because they need the person that they're talking to understand what they're saying. And, you know, it makes it even harder because they might say a perfectly grammatically correct sentence with accurate vocabulary, and somebody's on the other side say, you know, I don't understand. What do you mean? And this is, I think, my interpretation of what the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu is saying, because he talks about, you know, social capital, and there is linguistic capital in that, which means it's not just do you have the vocabulary, do you have the grammar, but do you have the awareness of what exactly and how exactly to formulate your linguistic utterances to converge and resonate with the people that you're talking with, so that they are like, oh yeah, you know, I totally get you, or this makes complete sense to me, rather than I hear what you're saying, but no. And that's another aspect of it. And in the academic community, not only then are we suggesting that you need to be able to interact and you need to be able to speak eloquently and, you know, correctly, but you also need to be so aware of the wider community. So not just, you know, who are your teachers and your classmates or your professors on this campus, but who are the voices, who are the researchers, who are the names in this field, in this discipline, because that's also what you're going to do now in your discussions. You're going to add the voices, you're going to mediate in and show that not only have you done your research, just like my situation at that in that poetry class, but also that you understand and you feel like you're part of the community. So it's like, I don't know, it's like if I joined a basketball team, you know, it's like you give me the ball, do I know what to do with it? Yeah, you can put me on the team, but I get to play when I show you that I can dribble, I can shoot, I can pass, I can do all these other things. And I think that lots of times we kind of keep people doing the drill work. We keep our students doing that drill work instead of saying, okay, come on in and I'm going to teach you how, but I also, you know, you're now part of the community, your voice matters. And this is where I feel like I have really begun to shift in my role as an EAP instructor. And, you know, because until recently, I taught mediation as academic integrity. So I taught it as don't plagiarize. It's like, yes, you need to bring these voices in, but we're doing it so that, you know, you don't get expelled. You don't get kicked out of university. Whereas really, we're doing it because you're part of the community now. We're doing it because these are the names and these are the ideas and these are the people that are part of this conversation. And it's also, you know, an expected part of a low context, academic, linear, you know, explicit, direct communication community. And that is something that I've noticed is it has become a shift for me, is that definitely I don't want you to get expelled, but more importantly, I want you to be a contributing, constructing member of this community for which you have been accepted into, and you are, you know, coming to it every day and learning and participating in. So let's, you know, let's do it authentically. Let's bring in the voices. Let's mediate. Not because that's what you should do, but because this is what we do as members, common members, co-constructing members, mediating members of a community. Thank you for joining today. Encounters in the EAP Classroom is written, hosted, and produced by Laura McNabb. You can learn more about Laura and her teaching at her website, www.windowsoflife.com. If you have teaching ideas or would like to collaborate with Laura, she would love to hear from you. See you next time.